John chapter 9 this morning, verse 35 through 41. Let me just go ahead and read those passages. Jesus heard that they had put him out, that is the blind man, and finding him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he answered and said, "And who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, "We are not blind too, are we?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say, 'We see,' your sin remains." Now, chapter 9 is not the end of the conversation. The conversation is going to continue into chapter 10, where Jesus speaks of himself being the good shepherd, and that his sheep know his voice. And he is addressing this to the Pharisees that are there, and also to those who have professed a belief in him, but it's primarily to these Pharisees, these group of men who have already kicked the blind beggar, this beggar, out of the synagogue. And he's been ostracized. He's been kicked out. And we see Jesus come to him. Now, this past week, I watched a documentary on the orphan trains. And the orphan trains started in the mid to late 1850s and ran through 1929. And what they were primarily was they took orphan children from the inner cities of New York. A lot of these were kids of immigrants who were just living in squalor. Some of them weren't even orphans. They were just children who their parents could not keep. They just couldn't afford to feed them. They were living on the streets. They were living in squalor. And so this man who was a seminary student started trying to place these children with farm families in the West, thinking they would have a much better chance in life. They could be out of the city and placed with these farm families. And some of them turned out really good. They had went into good, loving homes. Some of them were treated as no more than slave labor. But in listening to some of these people who were still living, and they were interviewed, some that had been part of the orphan trains into the late 1920s, the thing that was a common thread between all of their stories was just how terrible it was to be an orphan. That there was just no sense of belonging. They didn't know who they belonged to, where they belonged. Just this sense of aloneness, that they didn't belong to anybody. This sense of rejection, that why doesn't anybody want me? And even after they were placed in a home, often this sense of rejection continued, because the other children, they knew they were orphans, and so they would tease them, and they would ostracize them, they wouldn't play with them. Even the parents of some of the other children would tell their children, "We don't want you playing with this one because he's an orphan. He comes from a bad background." And so there was just this overwhelming sense of, what's wrong with me? One lady said she would go home and look in the mirror at herself and just say, "What's wrong with me? Why doesn't anybody like me?" And they were just treated horribly. And so being an orphan was their fault. That these other kids were better than them just because of the accident of birth. And often they were told that, "Well, you just had bad blood. You know, your father was a drunkard, so you're going to be a drunkard. Your parents were immoral, so you're going to be immoral. You just had bad blood." Essentially, it was the modern version of what we see going on here in chapter 9. Who sinned? His parents or him? He's got bad blood. And we see this today. You know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Like father, like son, like mother, like daughter. They're just no good. They're no good. And so they get labeled, they get pigeonholed, they get stereotyped. And they think, people think they're superior because they have superior circumstances. And if their circumstances are superior to others, well then, people that are in inferior circumstances are inferior people. Well, Jesus always turns human wisdom on its head, doesn't he? He always puts the top on the bottom and the bottom on the top. That's just divine wisdom. The blind man sees, the seeing are blind. The beggar gets cast out, but the Pharisees are the ones who are out. The blind man's really in, the Pharisees are out. And you know, this blindness on the part of the Pharisees, it doesn't get better with time. Remember what the Pharisees did after Jesus' resurrection? They paid off the guards to spread these stories that the disciples had kidnapped him. They were not about to admit that Jesus really rose from the dead. Do you remember what they did with the apostles over in Acts chapter 4? You know, the apostles, Peter and John, are out proclaiming the gospel. And then in verse 16 and 18, they tell them, don't speak any more in this man's name. Peter and John just healed a crippled man. And they couldn't deny that a miracle had been done, but they weren't about to attribute it to Jesus. Don't preach any more in this man's name. Well, they keep preaching. So in Acts chapter 5, Peter preaches to them, the council, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court, that this man that you put to death, and it says that they were cut to the quick and they wanted to kill them, kill the apostles. Look what they did with Paul. They wanted to silence Paul. They weren't preaching Jesus. This man is preaching a message that's upsetting the whole world. We don't want that. Church history is full of examples. Full of examples of this. From the early martyrs to the Reformation to even today, there's just a willful blindness to spiritual truth. There's some lessons we can learn here from the blind man. Not just the fact of the miracle, not just the spiritual lesson that's here in terms of that only God can give sight to the blind, the spiritually blind, that it's a gift of His. Now, there's other lessons. I mean, the lesson is that opposition is to be expected, right? Opposition to truth is to be expected. It's not a strange thing. What did Peter say in 1 Peter 5? No, don't be amazed. Don't think some strange thing's happening to you when this is going on. No, but to the degree that you suffer for the name of Christ, rejoice. You're blessed. So how do you deal with this? How do you deal with this opposition that's to be expected from the world and even from organized religion? It was the Catholic Church that was in opposition to Martin Luther, to the Reformers. It's the organized church today that's in opposition to the truth of the Bible. So how do you deal with it? Well, we learned from the man, from the blind beggar, you deal with it with courage, boldness. You deal with it with honesty, with the conviction of truth. That this is true. I was blind, now I see. You can't deny that truth. You have to deal with the truth, not with your presuppositions. It's with the conviction of the truth. And it's a willingness to suffer the consequences for standing for the truth. So when this man was put out, his being put out doesn't show that he was wrong. It doesn't show that the Pharisees are right. It shows that they are blind. And so that's what opposition shows. Just because the majority are in opposition doesn't mean they're right. Very rarely is the majority ever right about anything. It's not the majority that rules. What it just shows is that they're blind, not that they're right. And so we come to this last part. Again, Jesus reappears. Jesus has been missing from this entire account since he healed the man. The whole rest of chapter 9 has just been the dialogue between the blind man and the Pharisees, and the blind man's parents and the Pharisees. But now Jesus reappears, and it's just so beautiful. Jesus heard they had put him out, and he found him. Jesus finds him. Why? Because he'd heard he'd been put out. He'd been ostracized. He'd been shunned. Well, why had he been ostracized and shunned? For his testimony of Jesus, his bold proclamation of Jesus, his stance for the truth, for saying, I was blind, now I see. Deal with this truth. And they refused to. He essentially just told them, listen, this is what I used to be like, and now I'm like this. Well, the problem was, he was dealing with people who were still like he used to be. And see, that's all why we hit opposition. Why, when we proclaim the truth to people who think they see, but are still blind, you know, you proclaim the truth and you say, this is the way I used to be. This is the way I am now. This is what the truth means. These are the implications of the truth. Well, we're often talking to people who are still in the same condition that we used to be. They just can't see it. So they don't like what he's telling them. They don't like what he's telling them that he now sees. He sees Jesus. He sees Jesus as he is. But they don't, and they will not. They refuse. Verse 35 of John chapter 9 is such a wonderful illustration of Psalm 27:10. For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me up. Isn't that what just happened here? I mean, his mother and father just kind of threw this guy to the lions. Left him twisting in the wind because of their fear of man. But here the Lord is coming and taking him up. And Jesus asks him a question. Do you believe in the Son of Man? Again, the parallels between here and chapter 5, parallels in the contrast, are quite stunning. Because that when Jesus had healed the paralytic, in chapter 5, this paralytic didn't stand up for Jesus. He didn't say, I was crippled, now I'm walking. Deal with that, Pharisees. No, the Pharisee said, who told you to carry your bed? And the guy said, I don't know. And when he did find out, he goes, says, there's the guy who told me to carry my bed. He didn't say, there's the guy who healed me. No. But in verse 14, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, behold, you've become well. Do not sin anymore so that nothing worse may befall you. He didn't say, do you believe in me? Do you believe in the Son of Man? No, he tells him, don't sin anymore. Well, what did he do? In the next verse, verse 15, the man went away, told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. Yeah, here's the guy who healed me. Here's the guy who told me to pick up my pallet. He didn't ask the paralytic, do you believe in the Son of Man? Because there had been no bold testimony. There had been no bold stance already. This man, the blind man, had already paid a price. He had taken a bold stance. And so Jesus asked him, do you believe in the Son of Man? He's not asking, do you believe in His existence? He's saying, do you believe? It's a present tense. Is this what you constantly, continuously, habitually do? Do you believe? Do you trust? Are you totally dependent? He's not asking for a one-time profession. He's not asking him to close his eyes and bow his head and raise his hand. He's not asking for anything that we see in modern-day altar calls. Do you believe in the Son of Man? Is there this total trust, total dependence? It's the same thing. John 3:16. God so loved the world that He sent His only begotten Son, that whoever believes, present tense, believes in Him continuously, constantly, trusts. It's not talking about a one-time profession. You believe. See, here's a lesson. This man's knowledge of Jesus is growing. It's growing and increasing. He's now getting to where he can have an object for his faith. And what's the lesson? Well, it's that true knowledge, genuine faith, is often the consequence, and more than likely the consequence, of breaking with false religion. It's breaking with the shallow, with the worldly, with the unbiblical. This man could not have come to a true knowledge of Jesus if he had remained within the system. It would have been impossible within the system. And once he did find out, it would be impossible to remain within the system. He just couldn't have done it. And he couldn't have gone back to the system. That's the message of Hebrews, isn't it? Don't go back there. There's nothing back there for you. That's a false system. That system's obsolete. It's gone. Here's the reality. And so the true knowledge is a consequence of getting out, of breaking with these false systems. And so we see people today in churches. They're false churches. But they refuse to leave the church because that's where all their friends are. This is the denomination they grew up in. It's just tradition. This is what they're comfortable in. And as a result, they never know, they never grow, they never come to a real, true knowledge of Jesus Christ. Because it's impossible within the false system. And if he had remained in the system, like the cripple in chapter 5, he would not have come to a true knowledge. So the best place for a true believer to be is to be away from the enemies of the gospel, to be away from self-serving religion, from those who promote human achievement. Then Jesus comes and reveals himself. So he asks, do you believe? That word you, it comes first in the sentence in the Greek. So the emphasis is on that. You believe? As in contrast to these Pharisees who don't. But you see, this is the way salvation is, isn't it? Salvation is always personal. It's always individual. Jesus didn't ask, do your parents believe in the Son of Man? He didn't ask, does your church believe in the Son of Man? Does where you worship believe in the Son of Man? Does your community, does your country believe in the Son of Man? He didn't ask that. Do you believe in the Son of Man? That's the question. You see, this is a question we need to ask ourselves daily, isn't it? Not in terms of salvation, but just in life's trials. Do you trust the Son of Man in this situation? Where is your trust? Do you really believe God's promises? Do you believe God's word, what He has said? See, this is what true faith is. It is unqualified trust. What did Job say? Job 13:15. Even though He slays me, yet I will trust in Him. 2 Timothy 1:12. In Paul's death row epistle, not too long before he's beheaded. But Paul wrote, 2 Timothy 1:12, for this reason I also suffer these things. But I'm not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and I am convinced that He is able to guard what I have entrusted to Him until that day. Why was he convinced? Why was Paul convinced? Because he knows in whom he had believed. That's a big question. The people know who they say they believe. You can't worship what you don't know. You can't love what you don't know. Paul knew whom he had believed. And this is what Jesus is asking this man. Do you believe in the Son of Man? Notice he didn't say, do you believe in me? Do you believe in Jesus? He said, do you believe in the Son of Man? Some manuscripts read the Son of God, but the earliest and best manuscripts all agree that it's the Son of Man. This is just Jesus' self-designation. He refers to himself by this always. And there's no other place in the New Testament except one where people ask Jesus, who is this Son of Man? That's the only other place in the New Testament where it's not Jesus. The only place in the New Testament where it's not Jesus referring to himself this way. All the other occurrences of Son of Man, it's Jesus referring to himself this way. This is his self-designation. And of course, it comes from Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 and 14, where Daniel says, I saw one like a Son of Man coming up to the Ancient of Days, and thrones were given to him. So this is a messianic term. It's a term for the Messiah. It points to Jesus' unique nature. He is the Son of Man, not a Son of Man. You believe in the Son of Man, the one that's sent by the Father, the one that came into this world. See, he's man, he's fully human, but he's a Son of Man. The Son of Man, unique. He's the Word that became flesh. He's a unique individual. He's a specific individual. See, this is the object of faith. Son of Man. This is the Jesus that is to be the object of faith. Any other Jesus is not the Son of Man. You ask professing Christians today if they believe in Jesus, and they'll say yes. And often what they mean is they believe in the existence of Jesus. Well, demons believe in the existence of Jesus. But ask them to describe Jesus to you. Ask them to describe the Jesus they believe. Ask them what they know about Jesus. And you'll get answers from biblical to bizarre. It's all over the map. You see, faith in Jesus is a faith in a specific person. What did John say in 1 John? Many antichrists have gone out in the world. You know, there's a lot of Jesus is being preached out there, that Jesus has not come in the flesh. See, they weren't not preaching Jesus. They were just preaching a Jesus that hadn't come in the flesh. A Gnosticism. An insipid form of Gnosticism. Well, there have been false Jesuses preached throughout church history. And so people, just because they say they believe in Jesus, we need to clarify, what Jesus do you believe in? Because there's a lot of Jesuses out there. Jesus said, you know, in the latter days, false Christs are going to arise who will lead many people astray. Well, they're here. They're all around us. It doesn't have to be a Jim Jones or somebody stands up to proclaim that there's some type of Messiah. No, there's false Jesuses all over the place that are leading people astray. You got the Jesus, the health, wealth, prosperity Jesus. You got the Jesus of self-esteem. You got the Jesus of self-indulgence. You got the Jesus of self-gratification. You got the Jesus of self-fulfillment. There are lots of Jesuses out there. The question is, do you believe in the Son of Man? That's the question. God incarnate, one who possesses all the attributes of God. He's love. He's holy. He's just. He's righteous. He's immutable, unchanging. Well, it's not likely this is the Jesus you're going to believe if you're in an environment where he's not taught, or where he's mistaught, or where he's misrepresented, like he was in apostate Judaism here. So he doesn't ask, do you believe in Jesus? He doesn't ask, do you believe in me? He says, but do you believe in the Son of Man? The Jesus of the Bible. This is who we have to believe in. The Son of Man. And so he asked the question, the beggar asked the question, who is he? Lord? And some English translations translate that word Lord as sir, which is probably more accurate. Who is he? Sir, term of respect. Because he don't know who Jesus is yet. Who is he, sir? Well, that's a good question. See, that's a question we need to ask people today. Do you believe in the Son of Man? And if they answer yes, we'll say, well, who is he? Who is he? See, you need to have the right object of faith. We need to ask this question today. And when you do, you're going to get a myriad of answers. People are told to believe in Jesus with no idea of who he is. They have no idea who he is. They have no clue of what he demands. There's no sense of counting the cost of what it means to believe in the Son of Man. Well, this beggar's question, it's not just mere curiosity. He's not asking for the purpose of sizing up Jesus, seeing if he wants to try him on for size. Remember, it used to be a church in the, it's still around, but they used to have a billboard up that said, try Jesus, try Jesus. Well, yeah, let's just try him on for size, see if he fits. And if he's comfortable and fits my life, then yeah, I'll take that Jesus. No, he can help you out. That's not what this guy's doing. He's not looking to pass judgment so that he can make a decision. No. What's his purpose? Why does he want to know? Who is he, Lord? That I may believe in him. That's the whole purpose for asking. Just that little word, that, Greek word, henna, it's a purpose statement. In order that, so that I may believe in him. See, he's eager to know. This guy's just been so disillusioned by the religious establishment, disillusioned with the ignorance and the arrogance of their religious leaders who know nothing. He's fed up with their superficial religion that exists nothing but in ceremonies, but has no heart, no soul. It's all external, nothing internal. So he's asking, who is to be the object of my faith? It can't be my works. It's not this system. Who, what person is the object of my faith? See, the Pharisees could have cared less who he is. Jesus has been telling him over and over and over again. But they could have cared less. They rejected what Jesus said. They already have their own opinions about Jesus, and they're very confident in their own opinions about who Jesus is and who Jesus is not. They have no desire to have their own view challenged. In fact, they won't even tolerate it. I mean, this is exactly what Paul said. Day will come when they will not tolerate sound doctrine. Well, sound doctrine is nothing but truth. Truth has implications. This is why Jesus told them, the reason you don't believe me is because I speak the truth. Sound doctrine is truth. And truth has implications. And people don't like the implications, so they won't tolerate it. And this is what's going on here. They wouldn't tolerate it. But the beggar, he's eager to know. He's eager to trust in this Son of Man. He's eager to serve him. He's eager to be devoted to him. How do you know that? Because what does he do when he finds out who he is? He worships. He worshiped him. That's what it means to worship. You're devoted to him. Well, Jesus' answer to the man's question is almost identical to his answer to the woman at the well. In verse 25 of chapter 4, the woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, and he who is called Christ. When that one comes, he will declare all things to us. And Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. Here he answers the blind man's question. You have both seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you. What was the woman at the well's problem? Jesus told her in chapter 4, verse 22, you worship that which you do not know. There you go. There's your problem. You could hang that sign over the vast majority of what calls itself the church in this country. You worship that which you do not know. That's what was happening. They weren't atheists. They were following, they thought, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The woman even says, our father Jacob dug these wells here. So they had the same religious heritage, the same religious traditions. But they didn't worship what they knew. They were ignorant of the true God. And so, what does Jesus tell them? You have both seen Him. You have both seen Him, and He is the one who is talking with you. You've seen Him. You've seen the Son of Man. He didn't say you've seen Jesus. He said you've seen the Son of Man. Well, now this guy, an epiphany is going off in his head. He knows that this would have been impossible just a few hours earlier, or a day or two earlier. That's impossible. You're right, I am seen. And he knows it. And so now in his mind, Jesus, the Son of Man, Jesus, the Son of Man, they're beginning to come together. They're merging. They're the same person. Jesus is Messiah. Messiah is the Jesus. Well, what's the purpose of John's Gospel? John chapter 20, verse 31. These things I've written so that you may know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that knowing you may believe and have eternal life in His name. See, this is what He's doing. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is not only the Son of Man, the Son of God. So you see Him. Not only do you see Him, in fact, He's the one who's talking with you. Here is the object of His faith. This Jesus, this man, the Son of Man, the Messiah, who has revealed Himself. This is the object of His faith. So what's a man's response? A man's response is immediate, instantaneous. He doesn't say, let me think about this a little while. I'm not sure you measure up to what I want you to be. Thanks for the sight, but, you know, I think I'll go stick with what I know over here, where all my friends are, where the people I know are. What does he say? Lord. And this is not sir. This is Lord. He knows who Jesus is now. Lord, I believe. Present tense. It's instantaneous. It is public. This profession just made a total separation, a total break with all his past religious heritage. What he says is, Lord, I trust you. I entrust myself to you. I submit to you. So this is a far cry from a shallow profession of faith, from walking an aisle and praying a prayer. This is not just mental assent to some facts about the gospel. He is identifying himself with Jesus because of who he is. But the Pharisees, they reject all who Jesus is. And so in identifying with Jesus, not only does the man identify with all of Jesus, with who he is, he rejects everything that denies who he is. He's rejected all that old system. He's walked away from the system that is rejecting and denying the true Jesus. And he worshiped him. He worshiped him. Adoration. This is true heart felt worship, true submission. Psalm 2, again a messianic psalm, concludes the last two verses of Psalm 2. Worship the Lord with reverence. Rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, lest He become angry and you perish in the way. For His wrath may soon be kindled, How blessed are all who take refuge in Him. This is what this guy has done. He's taken refuge in Jesus. He's been cast out by everything else. He takes refuge in Jesus. He does homage to the Son. He is worshiping with reverence. It's not this flippant, casual entertainment rock concert. That is blasphemous. He worshiped Him. This is the only other time in the New Testament, the only other occurrence in the New Testament where people worship Jesus before His resurrection. Matthew 14, after Jesus stills the sea, it says the disciples worshiped Him. Here you have this blind beggar who now sees he worships Him. And guess what? Jesus accepts it. He accepts worship. This would be blasphemous if Jesus were not God. This would be a violation of the first and second commandment. No angel will ever accept worship. So for Jehovah's Witness to say that Jesus is an angel, and I've asked them these, who do we worship? Do we worship God? Do we worship Jesus? And they say, oh no, we only worship Jehovah. I said, but yet it says that these people worship Jesus. Well, they're just showing reverence to Him. Well, that's not what the word means. In John's Gospel, it always, always means worship, worship. This was His response to truth. Jesus has revealed Himself. You see, this is a response of everyone who sees Jesus as He really is. When you see Jesus as He really is, you can't have this shallow, superficial, entertainment, carnal worship. You're not worshiping the Son of Man. You're not worshiping Jesus. You're worshiping yourself, your own idea and concept of Jesus. When there's a true knowledge of Jesus, there is true worship. The only response to truth is worship. But yet so much today, it's all about creating an emotional response. Well, the end result of an emotional response is a good feeling. It lasts about 30 minutes. The end result of truth is worship. That lasts every moment of every day as we know Jesus. It characterizes our life. So this man's worship would be blasphemous if Jesus is not God. But see, people can't worship what they don't know. But people will always worship what they love the most. And so people worship what they love the most and what they know the most, which is self and the world. It's been that way forever. Go back to Jeremiah. Jeremiah 1:16. What are the people worshiping there? I will pronounce My judgment on them concerning all their wickedness whereby they have forsaken Me and have offered sacrifices to other gods and worshiped the works of their own hands. That's what people worship. Their own ideas, their own schemes, the work of their own hands. Even when they were going through the wilderness and being cared for by God constantly through their receiving manna, receiving quail, their shoes didn't wear out, their clothes didn't wear out. What does God ask them? In Amos chapter 5, verse 25, did you present Me with sacrifices and grain offerings in the wilderness for 40 years, O house of Israel? You also carried along Sikuth, your king, and Kian, your images, the star of your gods, which you made for yourselves. That's what they were worshiping in the wilderness. They brought along their own idols. No, this man, he worshipped Him. The Son of Man, Jesus. Well, in verse 39, Jesus now explains the spiritual significance of what just happened. It's not just a miraculous event, the healing of a blind man. It's not just a difference of opinion over Jesus between blind man and the Pharisees. No, Jesus is explaining the spiritual significance of what happened here. What all this means. What this was meant to teach. It was to reveal the spiritual condition of mankind. This is the core of all our problems. And the only solution is Him, the Son of Man. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." See, this is why all this has happened. This is the purpose of this object lesson. Now, this doesn't contradict what Jesus said back in 3:17, where He said, "For God did not send the Son into the world to judge the world, but that the world should be saved through Him." It doesn't contradict what Jesus says again over in chapter 12, verse 47, when He says, "And if anyone hears My sayings and does not keep them, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world." But yet here Jesus says, "For judgment I came into this world." Well, this is not a contradiction. See, out of all of humanity, Jesus came to save some. He came to save some. But saving some entails judging others and condemning others. And this is a twofold judgment. Jesus is describing here a twofold judgment. "For judgment I came into this world." Well, what kind of judgment? Well, first, that those who do not see may see. See, there's one form of judgment. There's a judgment of blessing. Those who know their helpless condition, those who know their desperate need, those who understand that they're totally dependent upon God, that they can't change their self, they know they're blind, they lack light, they want to know that they may see truth, they may see Jesus as He is. Jesus said, "I didn't come for those who are healthy, He came for the sick. He didn't come for the rich, He came for the poor. He didn't come for the wise, He came for the foolish. He came for those who were not blind to their true condition." But of course, we're all blind to our true condition until God opens our eyes. "No man can come to Me unless the Father draws him." That's regeneration. God opens our eyes, gives us a new birth. And in that new birth we have sight. And we see ourselves, we see our wicked, desperate, despicable condition, our helpless, hopeless condition, that we can do nothing to save ourselves. And we run to Him as the only source, the only means of being saved. And cast ourselves in on Him and say, "Save me, a sinner." This is who He came. That those who do not see may see. But He also came for a second reason. That those who see may become blind. Well, everybody's naturally blind. This is a judicial blindness. A judicial blindness. It is irreversible. John chapter 12. Concerning the Jews, John writes in verse 39, "For this cause they could not believe. For Isaiah said again, 'He has blinded their eyes, He has hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes, perceive with their heart, and be converted, and I heal them.'" This is irreversible. This is a judicial blindness. Well, who does this happen to? You know, people say, "Well, yeah, that's for the Hitlers of the world. That's for all these pagans. That's for that's for the Ayatollahs. That's for all these wicked, wicked, depraved people. The pagans, the atheists, the irreligious. That's who this happens to." No, Jesus, I believe in, would never do this. He would never make it impossible for somebody to come to repentance. No, all these wicked people, the atheists, the pagans, the irreligious, they're blind by reason of a natural blindness. There's still hope for them. Who are these who are judicially blind? It's the religious people. The ones who are exposed to light over and over and over, but they reject it and they reject it. In Romans chapter 11, Paul wrote concerning the Jews in his defense of God, Romans 9, 10, 11. But in Romans 11, verse 7, what then? That which Israel is seeking for, it is not obtained, but those who were chosen obtained it, and the rest were hardened. Just as it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes to see and not, and ears to hear not, down to this very day. And David says, let their table become a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a retribution. Let their eyes be darkened to see not and bend their backs forever. See, they were hardened. They can't see, can't believe. And people say, well, yeah, but those are the people that crucified Jesus. Jesus was right with them all the time, and they're the ones who crucified him. That doesn't apply to today, does it? Well, what does the author of Hebrews say? Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24. If we go on sinning willfully after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain terrifying expectation of judgment and the fury of a fire which will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much severe punishment do you think he will deserve who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has regarded as unclean the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has insulted the Spirit of grace? And in Hebrews chapter 6, for in the case of those who have once been enlightened, tasted the heavenly gift, been made partakers of the Holy Spirit, have tasted the good word of God, powers of the age to come, see, they've had all this light given to them, and then have fallen away. It's impossible to renew them again to repentance, since they again crucify to themselves the Son of God, put him to open shame. Yes, spiritual, judicial blindness is still for today. There's no reason to assume that God does not still inflict this on people. And where is it to be found predominantly? Among religious people, where there's the most light. And typically it comes from abusing God's grace, abusing God's light, abusing His truth, contempt of His truth. People are obstinate in their sin who have been given over to the lusts of their heart. These people don't become atheists. They become idolaters. The idolatry of their own mind. They worship the Jesus of their own imagination. Matthew 7:21, didn't we do all this wonderful stuff in your name? Lord, Lord, depart from me, I never knew you. They were worshiping a Jesus of their own imagination. See, Jesus didn't come to make immoral people moral. He didn't come to make the unchurched churched. He didn't come to make the irreligious religious. He came to give sight to spiritually blind people, to save the lost, to heal the sick. He didn't come for the self-satisfied, for the self-sufficient. He came for the desperate, for the helpless, for the hopeless. Well, Jesus' explanation just gets a scoffing response, which is typical. Just a response from the Pharisees. And it's typical of those who are blind. This isn't just the Pharisees. This isn't unique to them. This happens to all people who are spiritually blind, especially those who are judicially blind. Again, this has been happening throughout the history, not only the nation of Israel, but the history of the world. But the nation of Israel serves as a good illustration. And you have Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 35. The people say, Yet you said, I am innocent. Surely his anger is turned away from me. Behold, I will enter into judgment with you, because you say, I have not sinned. This is what we do. What do we do? What's so wrong in what we're doing? And in Jeremiah 16:10, God tells Jeremiah, now it will come about, when you tell this people all these words, that they will say to you, for what reason has the Lord declared all this great calamity against us? What is our iniquity? What is our sin which we have committed against the Lord our God? Then you are to say to them, it is because your forefathers have forsaken me, declares the Lord, and have followed other gods and served them and bowed down to them. But me they have forsaken and have not kept my law. So their forefathers did what? They committed idolatry. Well, that was what their forefathers did, but what about them? Verse 12, you too have done evil, even more than your forefathers. For behold, you are each one walking according to the stubbornness of his own evil heart, without listening to me. So not only did their forefathers walk were idolaters, so are they. But the thing is, they aren't even listening to correction. They aren't even listening to reproof. They aren't even repenting. They just sit around and say, what have we done? What's so bad about what we're doing? Well, the Pharisees' response is so similar. And it's very self-centered. We're not blind too, are we? Now, they're kind of dense here. They still don't get the spiritual implications here. They're not speaking this in spiritual terms. What they're essentially saying is, we're not the ones who were born blind. We're not the ones under God's curse. We're not like this ignorant beggar too. Surely you're not insinuating that we're like this guy right here, that we're in sin and born entirely in sins. We're not. You're not insinuating that we're of the same caliber as somebody like this. Well, Jesus' answer is just, again, so penetrating, very sarcastic. If you were blind, you would have no sin. And the if there, this is a second class conditional clause, which just means it's a contrary to fact statement. If you were blind, and you're not. Because he came to give sight to those who were blind, who knew their need, who understood their depravity, who understood their need of salvation. So Jesus said, if you were blind, you wouldn't have any sin. Well, wait a minute. Isn't this man's blindness proof positive that he's a sinner, that he does have sin, that he was born entirely in sins, that he is a wretched sinner? Well, Jesus said that if you were blind, you wouldn't have any sin. If you were like this guy, you wouldn't have the sin. See, being blind just proves you have sin, right? According to their way of thinking. But again, Jesus just turns their thinking on its head. Listen, if you really knew your true condition, if you had not had so much light, so many spiritual privileges, if you had longed for the truth, if you were hungry to know, but you don't, your blindness would just be natural, not willful. If you were blind like this beggar, you would have a natural blindness, and you have no sin. But you're not. But since you say, we see, and again, present tense, they're saying this over and over again, we see, we see, we see. Hey, there's nothing wrong with us. We're fine just the way we are. What are you saying we're a sinner, that we're wrong, that we're doing, that what we think is wrong, that the way we worship is wrong, that what we believe about God is wrong, what we believe about salvation is wrong? We see. Since you deny your true condition, you deny God's word, you deny His salvation, you think you can earn your way to heaven and thereby you deny His holiness, Your sin remains. Now, Jesus is not talking about their present spiritual condition. This is a pronouncement of judgment. It remains, present tense, continuously, habitually. There's no hope. You are fixed in your sin. You're hardened. There's no hope for you. See, only God can pronounce this kind of judgment. Only God. We don't know who these people are, but we do know that the vast majority of them exist where there's the most light. This is terrible. This is terrible. But it's what John said at the beginning of his gospel, isn't it? The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. See, there's only two responses to truth. And there's two corresponding judgments to those responses. For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see. See, there's one judgment in response to truth. But then there's another judgment. Those who see may become blind. The people where God has opened their eyes, where they see their deplorable condition, that they have no hope of salvation, they cannot depend on their self. There's no prayer they can pray. There's no work they can do. There's no aisle they can walk. There's nothing they can do to save themselves. All they can do is cast themselves on the mercy of the only one who can save. To those, Jesus came to give sight. There's a corresponding judgment to the response to truth. To receive truth. To embrace truth. To believe truth. There's light. But to reject truth, there's darkness. There's judgment. There's blindness. See, there's only one true Jesus who is the object of faith. Many, many false Christs, antichrists, have gone out into the world. Many, many false Jesus out there. There's only one true Jesus who can be the object of our faith. And I pray that we all worship the true Jesus. Let's pray.